You are now listening to The Liminalist, the podcast between Jason Horsley talking to Gregory Desolay. But the hottest time of dawn is in the evening when it feels like all the world is unchained. My parents locked me up even though I was screaming. They kicked me down till I did not feel.
I was wanting to talk with you again because after we had done the podcast, I got to thinking because you had made a statement there that kind of stuck in my head, and I continued pondering. You had said at one point that you had experienced some movies or films that seemed to be in the strongly in the melodramatic structure that you thought were powerful and good films. And I got to thinking about that and saying, well, you know, based on what I've been saying, I would be inclined to argue against that. But then I got to thinking more and saying, well, you know what? I think Jason might be right there. And so I began rethinking some things surrounding melodrama, and wondered if you would be open to exploring it a bit. I wanted to read a couple of sentences from my book, Our Faith in Evil, and then I wanted to look at a chapter of yours in Seen and Not Seen.
Mm-hmm.
If that's agreeable with you.
Yeah, sure.
The way I began rethinking this was that, and when I was writing Our Faith in Evil, I didn't know quite what to do with my thinking about myth and mythology, and let's say the work of Joseph Campbell, as illustrated, let's say, in his book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces.
Interesting coincidence, because I just did this video, I don't know if you saw it or heard about it, but it's on the same blog post that I put your work about, your thing about Desolate. But anyway, I'm sorry, about Derrida, Freudian slip there. But I mentioned, anyway, in that video, I mentioned Campbell and The Hero of a Thousand Faces because of the connection to Jordan Peterson. So that's an interesting synchronicity.
Oh, I'll have to check that out. Yeah, I wasn't aware of that. So, that is interesting coincidence. But I read The Hero with a Thousand Faces too many years ago.
Same.
So I'm relying on a recollection that's probably sketchy. But, you know, it just occurs to me that there are so many myths that, and including some of the premier Greek myths like Perseus and Theseus and Hercules, and that, you know, could be placed in kind of a melodramatic structure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then it occurs to me that, you know, the Greeks came along much before Christianity, and I think it was really with the rise of Christianity. Well, according to Nietzsche, it was with Zarathustra in Persia that the whole notion of good and evil, as we tend to understand it in modern times, got started. And so the Greeks and Nietzsche, it makes a big point out of this in his book, Genealogy of Morals, how the Greeks were approached the dichotomy more from the notion of good versus bad instead of good versus evil. And it's an interesting distinction. But if you look at some of the mythology and approach the pre-Christian myths from a direction, or the even myths from around the world, from other cultures, the good evil template doesn't fit over them so easily. And so you begin to wonder, well, when you encounter a myth that kind of looks like melodrama, is it really? And if not, what's going on and what's the appeal? And so this was something in this passage I was going to read in my book. I'm saying Campbell's examination of myth suggests that it is a form that is broader than melodrama, while also different from tragic drama. Myth includes story forms that show heroic triumph, but that do not contain the radical polarization and violence of melodrama. And then I got to looking back at your book, and at the end of and this will tie in kind of obliquely, but eventually, your chapter "Sympathy for the Damned," and at the end of that, you on the last page, you mention fairy tales, and you're saying something that I found really interesting. You say, if movies are a disembodied and dissociating medium, it makes sense that we look to them to remind us as frequently and furiously as they can of our physicality. Children love fairy tales that are gruesome and gory, probably for the same reason. And I thought, there's not only myths, but there are fairy tales to consider. And it's quite obvious, that a lot of fairy tales will also fall into the category of dramatic structure. So I'm thinking, what is it that draws people to these things? And you go on to say something that I really had to start pondering, and that is that art recognizes no barriers of decency or anything else. And because it doesn't judge us for our failings, unlike family members, and turns no one away from its doors, it proves a home for the displaced. And I thought, well, okay, yeah, not just drama or fairy tales or myths or stories, but art in general. You seem to have a very broad concept of it, and I think, you're saying that it works in a lot of different ways for different people in different stages in their lives.
Was that quote, was that actually my words? Because it was kind of unfamiliar, I see. It wasn't a Pauline Kael paraphrase, or it wasn't referring to Pauline Kael, was it?
Well, I'm not sure. It comes on page 208 if you have your book in front of you.
Yeah, I'm about to do that. It does begin with returning to Kael's definition of the artist's task, but it, no, you're right, it's my quote. Funny how it wasn't familiar to me. Anyway, sorry to.
That happens to me all the time.
Yeah.
Sometimes I go back to things I said in Our Faith in Evil, and I think, did I actually write that? But this is an interesting thing that you say, and I think it, I wouldn't argue against it, but it would be interesting to me if you could maybe expand on it a bit. Art recognizes no barriers of decency or anything else, and it doesn't judge us or turn anyone away from its doors. It provides a home for the displaced. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. And that gets to also the way in which you responded to a film like Taxi Driver versus the way I responded to it. Is there a, do you still feel that way? Do you resonate with that, what you're saying there still?
I do, and I don't. I mean, I wonder if the unfamiliarity of it is to do with having slightly changed my perspective, or if it's to do with it was just kind of pouring out of me when I was writing that book, which was the case. And so I just, I wasn't really attached to it. And, but maybe a combination of both. Of course, the book itself is kind of about me working out how much my sensibility is authentic to my nature and how much of it is culturally conditioned. And certainly I was culturally conditioned to believe in the power of art and the, art as a sort of religious surrogate, in more ways than one, and that all good art is inherently non-judgmental, let's say, which of course is, an ideal current ideology that's the high virtue, right? The one thing that people do get judged for is for being judgmental, kind of thing. That's one of those liberal paradoxes that you can bump into constantly nowadays. You're not supposed to make moral judgments about anything anymore. And so I was raised in that environment, and I think art did was kind of seen as exemplary of that, or at least I somehow picked up that idea that the opposite of art isn't so much trash as propaganda, as in and propaganda can be artful. Like the obvious example I use in Seen and Not Seen, I think it's in that book of Triumph of the Will. Not that I've seen it, but I've read enough about it. It's considered a masterpiece, but at the same time, it's Nazi propaganda. And, so that would seem to be, yeah. I mean, if you acknowledge that any sort of artful construct that is deliberately designed to indoctrinate us with ideological values is not art, then the opposite side of that is, or if you turn that around, you could say that real art never does that. It never moralizes, it never preaches. I also got that from Cale, that
Real art never moralizes or preaches.
which, I mean, she put it in a pithy way. That's saying it's one thing you say about great movies is they don't make us feel virtuous, I think is how she put it. But also, I mean, more obvious thing about, message movies and how they're never art. A movie that's delivering a message is not doing its job really as art, but as something else. So there's that sort of general thing about art, which I'd say I still agree with. But then there's the more specific thing, which is that I always felt that great art, one way or another, would look at not just human suffering, but the reasons for it, and by implication, the darkest aspects of the human psyche. So that it sort of had a responsibility, or just a natural predilection, or natural orientation towards exploring the worst aspects of human nature. And to do that, it couldn't judge them from the outside. It had to, and Dostoevsky is the clearest or easiest example for me anyway, because I really enjoy Dostoevsky, so I read him quite young. And like the way that he goes inside the psyche of the fallen man, or whatever we're going to call it, Raskolnikov specifically, and explores his reasons for doing what he's doing. And also, even Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, I remember the line in that, "Misery made me a fiend," so different from the, well, actually, the movies did kind of have a sympathetic Frankenstein, but certainly very different from the melodramatic thing, which is that the villain is simply this force of evil that has to be destroyed by the good. It seemed to me that the art was kind of duty bound to approach from the opposite perspective, from the inside out, and to actually get inside the disturbed psyche and help us to understand, you know, what disturbed it so much and what drove individuals to such terrible actions. And so that just seems to me the inverse of judging. And that, I think that's what I was getting at there. I mean, that's the whole chapter is about Sympathy for the Damned. Yeah? It's about how movies helped me to understand my own propensity for destructive behavior by giving me characters to identify with even that weren't heroic. So that's why I traced the, or I don't suppose Dirty Harry with Taxi Driver, because Dirty Harry just has a demonic villain that is to be destroyed by the glorified violent man. Yeah, you know, there's no ambiguity there. Whereas Taxi Driver, the hero is the villain, you know, and you can identify with him, as you point out in your essays, and people do, but you do so at a really high cost. And I was aware of that. And the movie does communicate that if a viewer is sensitive to it. And so I was aware of that.
Yeah, what you're saying here is very helpful, and I'm seeing better where you're coming from with that, and I think it makes a lot of sense. And one of the things that fits in with that is when you were talking, I think it's in the same chapter, you're talking about the Chainsaw Massacre, the movie, and the monster in that movie, and the way that you're talking about how there's almost at certain points a little bit of sympathy, or maybe a significant measure of sympathy, that almost gets going in the direction of the monster there.
Well, there's one point that I isolate in there where the Leatherface is in between chainsawing victims, like this, you know, mindless behemoth of destruction that he is, and he's just sort of sitting there, and it's like he doesn't really know what to do. And the film somehow captures, because he's masked, so you don't actually see the person behind the mask. You've got this monstrous apparition of destruction and mindless violence, but there is the sense in those moments that there's a human being behind that, behind the mask, literally, but also metaphorically behind this sort of manifestation of monstrosity, who is just lost and confused and acting out in, you know, in this really totally unconscious way. And I don't know how deliberate that was in the movie, or if it was just kind of organic because the movie kept, you know, there was something so realistic about the way it was shot and presented that they captured it by chance. But either way, it for me, it just led to this moment of sort of visceral realization. It wasn't really intellectual, but just of how awful it would be to be that person, to be Leatherface, just how, what a horrific situation the monster is in. As opposed, never mind the victims. I mean, obviously we're aware of that. So it wasn't sympathy with the villain in the sense of, it was the opposite of glorifying his actions or, you know, identifying with him because he's powerful, because that's really pernicious, obviously. And that horror movies do that. They make you sympathize with the villain in these awful, you know, just, you know, subversive ways. But it was the opposite of that. It was sympathizing with him because you could see that he was actually powerless and possessed by, you know, metaphorical demons. And in the worst possible spot imaginable, really, for a human being to end up in.
Yeah. And what you're saying there kind of ties in an interesting way with things that I say I'm trying to say in the first couple of chapters or so of Our Faith in Evil, where I get to a point where I'm talking about the monster in horror films, and I'm saying that you eventually come to a point where you're brought to realize, oh, you know what, the monster is me. and there's a kind of thing that goes on in some of the movies where where that effect is created, where you suddenly think, and I think that's part of the appeal of them too, is that all the way from the extremes of, say, something like the Chainsaw Massacre to and another more human end, like Taxi Driver, where you form a kind of identification, even perhaps unwillingly. I think that when in movies, there's an anti-heroic character or a monstrous character that is featured in a significant way, there is a tendency on the part of an audience to identify, even unwillingly. You begin to, based on sometimes the camera work and various things going on, you are given the perspective of the monster and made to see some things from the point of view of the anti-hero or the monster. And I think that also explains some of the appeal for adolescents, because as I'm working it out in this one chapter, it has a lot to do with sexuality, and that when you go through puberty, certain things happen to your body you have no control over, and it's like almost like you're being invaded from the inside. There's some strange force taking over your body, and you don't understand what it is. And especially if you have parents who haven't sufficiently prepared you for this, or indicated to you that certain things may be happening and what they're all about. And especially, I think Catholics run into that, and a lot of Catholic families, at least in mine. This kind of puberty overtakes you before you're really aware of what's going on. And I think there's a sense of yourself as becoming monstrous. And I think that there may be some connection there then between sexuality, violence, and horror films, and even slasher films, where adolescents are playing around with and struggling with these themes, and not knowing quite where to go with them.
And you point out in that part of the book as well how the adolescent, who's a male adolescent, the focus is on, right, whose libido is awakening, it has this experience of being possessed by some strange force, quite literally, and congruent with that, he becomes essentially powerless to the allure of attractive women. Like if he encounters an attractive woman who awakens this force in him, he can't do anything about it necessarily, and he can't, you know, if the woman simply rejects him or ignores him or doesn't, right, then he's left with just this overwhelming force of desire and nothing he can do about it short of violence, really.
Well, it's as if in a situation like that, the male feels assaulted, randomly assaulted. It's like, hey, I didn't ask for this. All of a sudden, this woman comes into my life, and I feel this about her, and it's as if she cast a spell on you or did something to you that you have no control over, and it feels like an assault. And so I think that's how some men, especially I think men who get into watching slasher films, can really connect with what's going on, because they have a sense of almost vengeance toward women to pay them back in kind, you know, for this assault. And I mean, I know this is not certainly the only way to read slasher films, but I think it can be an element in it where the male feels some sense of revenge toward women. Mm-hmm. And it gets played out in these films in a way that and strong identifications develop possibly with serial killers and slasher perpetrators. Mm-hmm. Along these lines, which are admittedly rather twisted, but there is a kind of perverse logic to it, as you're mentioning, I think.
Have you read Carol Clover's Men, Women, and Chainsaws?
Yes, I have a copy of that book, and I've read a good part of it. It's an interesting book. Mm. Yeah,
because it touches on a lot of this, and I mean, even just starting with the basic symbolism of the knife, you know, piercing the body is such an obvious surrogate, you know, or a violent transformation or debasement of the sexual urge. And I think, or the sexual act even, and I think this is why Psycho, I mean, all this relates to why Psycho is the central text, if you will, in this whole, in the genre, but also in what we're discussing now. I mean, it was the first slasher movie, essentially. It set the template thereafter. And it speaks back to what we were talking about initially, which is the identification, how Hitchcock, the thing that made Psycho so memorable, besides the fact that it was the first slasher movie, like the first modern horror movie, was the identification game he played, that you identify with the woman. For half an hour you're completely identified with her because she's on the run and in jeopardy and all the rest of it, and then she's killed, and so she's gone, you've lost your identification point, and then Norman Bates, who you don't actually know is the killer at this point, is cleaning up the mess, so you certainly know he's complicit, so he's definitely a criminal at that point, and you have no choice but to identify with him, and you're actually, as Hitchcock described it, he set it up so that you're siding with him, you want him to clean up the mess, just because that's the position you're in. You're identifying with somebody doing something quite mundane, which is cleaning up a bathroom, but you realize what the stakes are. And then right to the final thing with the car submerging, and it almost doesn't submerge. So Hitchcock's playing this game where he gets the viewer actually willing, like you were saying, like, reluctantly or unconsciously siding with the perpetrator of crimes. And of course by the end you discover that he was the killer, but in a sense, Norman Bates was somehow innocent because he was possessed by the spirit of his mother. So he, as a victimizer, he himself is a victim of his mother. And so in that whole Freudian complex, you've got the template for, I think, what I try and explore in Seen and Not Seen, why an adolescent, well, it's like it's not just the powerlessness of feeling assaulted by a woman because of being unable to have her, as we've described. Like, that is intense in and of itself, and that can certainly generate hostility towards women in and of itself. But at least based on my own experience, and again referring back to Psycho, I don't think that that would be sufficient or even be the case at all if it weren't for some sort of mother bondage that was imprisoning the male adolescent's libido at that crucial stage, so that he wasn't able to it just flow into his body, and he wasn't able to just express it and say to the woman or girl of his desire, "I want you," or, you know. And then even then, even if she rejects him, it would be okay because he himself had fully stepped into his manhood just by trying to claim her. You know, but because he's all tangled up with mother bondage, he can't even express his feelings for the woman, so then, or the girl, so then when she rejects or ignores him, the rage, the unconscious rage he has against his mother becomes more conscious and can actually come out in violence and or not, you know. But certainly it comes out, as you say, with a desire to immerse, as I did, immerse in these slasher narratives in which nubile young females are being violently penetrated. You know?
Yeah, what you're saying there makes me think that, yeah, there are levels. There's not just, let's say, one explanation or one key explanation for, let's say, male hostility toward women, or perverse anger toward women. There are layers of it, and that's one thing that I think plays into how I have perhaps misunderstood some elements of melodrama, or what I'm calling melodrama, in that it's possible to see perhaps an evolution in melodrama from fairy tales and myths up through stories and novels and movies of the modern era, where there's an evolution of the structure, in the sense that the kind of motivations that I deplored in the makers of melodrama and in the audiences, of this sort of like orgy of vengeance, and the hero is, you know, to be celebrated, and the destruction of the villain is to be celebrated, and everyone's happy at the end, and the world is cleansed, and all of these rather crude and simplistic notions. Certainly there are movies and films that fit that model, but when you go back in time and you go back through layers of what's going on in these kinds of polarized conflict situations, I think what you're saying there about, you know, or what I was saying about the adolescent hostility toward women because they can feel randomly assaulted by the beauty of a woman who comes along. That's one level of explanation, but what you're saying about, you know, the relationship, or the failed relationship between the mother and son, as being a deeper and perhaps more important level of motivation for anger. And I think that, these things, these motivations can become extreme to the point where, you know, you do arrive at notions of cosmological notions of evil as some thing that's inherently worthy of destruction. that should never have come into existence to begin with versus, you know, people who just happen to be, in doing things that kind of mess up your life, as perhaps, say, a bad relationship with your mother. And so there are these levels, and I think that complicates the way in which at least I should be looking at these conflict structures. And so that's one thing I think in reading your work that's come out for me, is that the versatility of your ways of looking at these things is very good.
Well, have you, I mean, staying on the subject of horror movies, I don't know if this came up already, or I know I've brought it up. I think it was talking to James Howard Councillor, how many horror movies have a relationship with a mother as central in some way.
Mm.
Often crazy mothers, even. Like Carrie is another obvious example. There's loads of them, actually. If you could do a sort of survey and just find out how many key horror movies have crazier mothers or dysfunctional child-mother relationships. And, you know, referring to your point about this sort of Manichaean melodramatic viewpoint that there's something so evil that it just has to be eradicated from existence, maybe this can be traced back to the infant experience in which it is, well, in the womb, it's literally, its world is its mother, okay? That is the infant's world. But even when the child is born, and there isn't much hard science about this, there isn't even much literature, but I think it's certainly, it kind of fits under the rubric of common sense, that the infant child, insofar as the mother's present at all, is still merged with the mother psychically. Like it may be physically separate, but it hasn't developed a separate sense of itself yet. And it develops that separate sense of self primarily in optimal conditions through its relationship with the mother. To have, you know, the mother smiles at the baby, and even from day one, the baby can smile back. The baby will imitate the mother's expressions and so on. And that's supposed to be how an infant begins to develop a sense of itself as a separate being. And so then you've got this extended period in which the consciousness of our consciousness, because we were all infants, is enmeshed or immersed or submerged in the mother's being, in her consciousness. And I think if the mother, and this is my own experience, well, she was alcoholic, so even in the womb, or especially in the womb, I was being polluted by her behaviors, literally. But then when I came out, you know, and met her, so to speak, as a person outside, she was pretty crazy and unbalanced and totally erratic. And so you can imagine, I mean, sort of try to imagine what that would be like when we don't even have an identity. And the thing that is we are looking to give us a sense of identity is malevolent.
Mm.
Then that would be ultimate evil. Like, that's as close as you could get to an experience of something that is just completely overwhelmingly evil and has no, you know, redeeming features, even though our mother, of course, does. I mean, that's part of the complex or central to it, is we can't actually reject our mother because we depend on her for our life. So it's like our identity itself gets forged somehow in this Manichaean way, I suppose, like it's split, divided within itself, you know, fearing and even hating the mother, but at the same time completely dependent on her and, you know, loving her desperately.
Yeah, and I think another interesting play on that whole theme is, and is raised by the whole issue of imitation. And that's one that the alternative explanation for the Oedipal complex that René Girard offers and that is that the way it gets started is that the sun grows up attaching to and wanting to imitate the father. Mm-hmm. And as this grows in the connection between the father and the son, the imitation grows, and then the mother comes into the picture because of the father's relationship to the mother, and so the son wants to imitate the father's relationship to the mother. Mm-hmm. Son also wants, you know, the mother to like him and to be able to do things for the mother, and et cetera, et cetera. And so Girard's notion is that this brings the father and the son into a rivalry, mm-hmm, with respect to the mother, not so much because the son wants to own the mother in the same way, but the son is imitating the father to the extent that almost to the extent of replacing the father. And so the tension, this creates a tension between the father and the son. And I thought that was an interesting way of looking at it, where it's kind of desexualized, and it's based more on less notions of libido and more on notions of imitation, mm, and the role that imitation plays in growing up. And this, I think, works in an interesting way in general with how people respond to films and stories and everything, because I think it's always key that identification is really crucial, that the success of a story or a film or a narrative of some kind is if there can be an identification form with a character. And in the family, according to Girard, this occurs, you know, with the son identifying with the father. And if this identification leads to conflicts and problems, then, you know, from this, we can sort out a lot of the difficulties that happen not only in families, but in life in general. And now I've lost a bit of the thread of where I was going with that.
Turning to movies to find figures to identify with?
Yeah, it relates to that, and it relates to the complexity of understanding the structure of the conflict. I mean, I've put melodrama into this category of being a very radical structure of good versus a radical kind of evil, a notion of evil as something that is so foreign that it doesn't even have a right to exist. And I think that there are so many dramas where what seems to be going on in conflict, there may be heroes and villains, but the villains are not really characters who should be thought of as not even having a right to exist. They're more like, you know, when you look at some of the great myths and even fairy tales, there's stories of the hero just overcoming obstacles, you know, and anything that gets in the way is oftentimes portrayed as a kind of monster, like the Minotaur or something like that. And the, mm-hmm, it's portrayed as a monster, but it's not, it's more to be understood, I think, as an obstacle, as something almost as a symbol of what the hero has to overcome in the process of being able to not only regard him as a hero, but almost as a rite of passage, as if, you know, in adolescence, in the transition from childhood to adolescence and manhood, there needs to be a rite of passage where a boy becomes a man and can feel that he has become a man. And in order for that to happen, you have to overcome some obstacles. I think that's that's the whole point, I think, of a lot of initiation rituals that used to be taking place in primitive societies, where they, you know, you would have to run some kind of gauntlet or go through certain harrowing experiences and come out the other side. As initiation rituals are all, I think, reflective of this, somehow finding a way to show a boy that he's now a man, and that he has to be acting like a man because he's going to be treated like a man. And that has broken down a lot, I think, in our modern culture, where there's not a clear initiation ritual. And it may be that films are depicting this, and that's and they have mistakenly gone too far in the direction of you know, creating obstacles that are so evil that they're ridiculous, you know. The point is not to manufacture extreme outrage in the hero or the audience, but I think more to show the hero overcoming obstacles and how the hero does that. And so, if what I'm saying here is making some sense, it would cause or necessitate kind of a revision of how I'm thinking of melodrama. Mm. I'm wondering what your thoughts on that are. It seems like you have a much more complex view of all of that, and if what are some of the things I'm saying there resonating for you?
I think it does come down to what you were saying there about the quality of emotional response to the obstacle. So I keep thinking The Matrix, like even before we started this conversation, I was thinking, well, that would be the most clear-cut example of a melodramatic movie that I think is meaningful and good, and you don't, it even refers to digression, if it was that, or our discourse about the mother's psyche, like The Matrix, even as a symbolic thing for the mother's psyche, you know, this immersion in the dream world. And Neo has to go through this rite of passage of confronting, you know, the obstacles, the agents of the Matrix, in order to, not individual, I don't want to use Jungianism, but in order to discover his true nature and, you know, enter into manhood, let's say, that's his rite of passage. And one of the things I would say that distinguishes The Matrix as a movie from the kind of melodrama that I agree is kind of pernicious is that I don't think it generates any hostility or hatred towards the agents or towards the Matrix. I mean, but then of course this is, I mean, maybe the key point is how the individual experiences the movie, because I can't speak for other viewers. Maybe there were viewers who hated the agents and were cheering when they got destroyed and so on. It's possible. But then there's people who watched Texas Chainsaw Massacre and cheered the villains on in that, right? So there's really no limit to, you know, the kind of possibilities for misinterpretation of texts. But just staying on that main point, that the hero, or rather the individual, and it seems to be a particularly male psyche that we're talking about, that needs to develop his own autonomy through extricating himself from the mother's psyche and influence and identifying with the father, if he's lucky enough to have one, and how that does involve a series of obstacles, like the father would lead the son, you know, into different situations where the son has to develop skill and competence and courage to overcome the obstacles with the father by his side. But then at a certain point, the father himself becomes the obstacle, right? That's traditional, and that's also, you know, it's a common experience. And even in the spiritual platitude, when you meet Buddha on the road, kill him, you know, that's a very violent, melodramatic image. But it doesn't have to be taken literally. And I think this is what we're talking around now, is that there are initiation rituals, whether they're consciously designed or not, that entail creating the semblance of an enemy. And it's necessary for the participant in the rite of passage, you know, the subject of it, to believe in the reality. It's like Paper Tiger. It's the book I wrote, but I mean, based on that, the thing, the Chinese thing, that the Paper Tiger is just an illusion. And it's there to bar the way, to make you think there's something monstrous there, so you shouldn't go there. But that's itself a test, because if you really, you know, if your desire is strong enough for autonomy or freedom, or, you know, self-knowledge, you will face the paper tiger, and then you'll find out that it's nothing. Yeah, you know, it's just an illusion. And that is sort of played out in The Matrix, because when Neo does confront Agent Smith, he just absorbs him. Like he's just, his chimera, he's just a sort of projection of Neo's own shadow, to use Jungian terminology.
Is that also perhaps one way to look at what's going on in the Fight Club, where the enemy turns out to be actually an aspect of yourself, a projection of sorts, and that is I mean, you have to kind of stretch the melodramatic structure to be one of, you know, one part of yourself against another part, where I think the way in which it might become unhealthy is if you think there is a part of yourself that needs to be eradicated rather than
integrated.
And but if those films like The Matrix and The Fight Club are you know, kind of modeling a kind of self-integration, then I think that what you're saying would be that they would fit a structure that I would find much more beneficial for audiences. That's a sense in which I would be perfectly willing to re-examine how I'm looking at The Matrix. I can see what you're saying there, perhaps a little more in the first film.
I don't count the other films.
the other films do seem to like go off the deep end a little.
They have no quality as artworks, in my view. So, and I think this is the thing that I was always trying to emphasize from Blood Poets on is that I don't think you can separate the medium from the message, that you can't separate, and this is my track with you and the movies that you chose as movies that you like, that I felt that whatever their message and their structure, they didn't have the quality of art. So to me, that anyway, it's kind of, well, it is, it's the medium and the message thing. It's like the quality of attention of the artists who are creating the art obviously informs the artwork, but I think what's less recognized is that like the meanings and the messages of a movie are also inseparable from the quality of that attention. So it's like this distinction we have between high art and low art, I think, is a false one, because there are movies that are pulpy, like The Wild Bunch is my favorite example, that, you know, because it's just a shoot 'em up Western in some level, but Peckinpah's immersion in the material was so great and his identification with the characters was so profound that he put his own soul, speaking, you know, obviously poetically, into that story. And so it becomes a representation of his own inner struggle with his own violence, and that's tragedy. So at that point, the pulp transcends the form, you know, and it becomes something else, and that's entirely dependent on the quality of attention of the individuals who are shaping their story. And so that's the thing that, and that in simple terms is that, you know, critical analysis, this is the thing I was aware of with Blood Poets, that there's all these academic books about movies that I read, and they never, Robin Wood was my bête noire in this regard, because he seemed to have awful taste in movies, but he was brilliantly insightful about analyzing the content. But anyway, just generally academic writers tend to separate, they tend to leave out the aesthetic qualities of texts when they analyze the text, and I don't think you can do that.
And that would be part of what you mean by the medium is a message. Well, what you're saying there about criticism and the possible, in connection with that, the possible role of a critic is also something that I've been re-examining. It's like, okay, granted all of these different ways of looking at films, what really is the role of a critic, if there is any role at all, in the sense of, is there any sense in evaluating films as good or bad? You know, are they good or bad? Well, if they're good or bad, then what is the reason? You know, how is it that a film can be bad? And I'm using the word very crudely there, but and here's something that you say that I quote in my book Our Faith in Evil that I think is really interesting. I have you saying, it's something you say in the Blood Poets, where you say, it may be that although no one mistakes movies for reality, a lot of people, maybe the majority, adopt many of their ideas about and responses to reality from movies. I thought that to me is a really insightful remark, because I think it's so true. And I think it's not only true of movies, it was true back before there were no movies, you know. When there were myths, when there were fairy tales, when there were stories or novels or whatever, those kinds of narratives expand our experience. It's like, it's like video games, you know. It creates a virtual reality for you to exist in and helps you to expand your experience as a human being. And because life is so short, and people don't have enough experience to gain enough wisdom, that these stories and everything are very helpful in expanding our knowledge base, expanding our experience, giving us a view of the world that we might not otherwise have through our own direct experience. And then on the basis of that, opening us up. And so it's possible, I think, for a lot of good to be done by these things. But then I think what you're saying in that quote is also true in that we learn from movies, we learn how to respond to events, to people, to experiences. And in that sense, even when movies are just trying to entertain us, they're also there's also a message there. There's a message in the medium, and the message is never just neutral. Just as you say in another place, where you're making an analogy between movies and advertising, and we can see the mechanism working so easily in advertising, where, say, a famous person like Tiger Woods is used to sell a product. We're supposed to identify with the representative, like with Tiger Woods, and then we're supposed to say, "Oh, okay, Tiger likes this, so I'm going to go out and buy these clubs or whatever." That identification is going on, and I think the heroes in films and stories are people we identify with, and there's something that, whether consciously or unconsciously, is getting sold. There's a point of view, and as critics, I think we have to try to identify what that is, and whether that sends us in a positive direction as a culture, or in a negative direction, or if there is any distinction to be made between decadence and healthy culture, then it would seem reasonable to suppose that distinctions can be made there. And so, but how do we do that?
Well,
It's so complicated because, like what you're saying, there's so many different ways in which people can respond to and identify with segments. And just like, for example, the difference between the way you and I responded to the film Taxi Driver probably has a lot to do with our previous life experiences and whatnot. For me, I am as a critic. I'm saying negative things about Taxi Driver, and you're saying very positive things. So where is there any objective place to come from with respect to evaluating that? I just don't know anymore.
Sometimes
Part two of this conversation with Greg Desolais will be up next week at horticulture.com/liminalist. This is Jason Horsley with the podcast Between.
I don't know what I'm doing. Some nights I go out drinking. But most of the time, I don't know what I'm thinking. This morning I went out trucking. I see. What I'm doing.